everyone, I'm Colin Ellis, best-selling author, award-winning public speaker, and facilitator of global workplace culture change. And in this, the Culture Makers podcast, I get people managers from around the world to share actionable things that you can do too to create a great place to work. I hope you enjoy the show. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Culture Makers podcast with me, Colin D. Ellis. And today I'm joined by Meredith Blackler. Meredith is the Chief People and Culture Officer at Wellington City Council. And she's a hugely experienced people professional and culture maker in every sense of the word. She's got over 15 years experience in the people space in the North Island of New Zealand, in places that some of you will never have heard of, like Leven and Palmerston North, and of course, the capital, Wellington. She also had 9 months stint in the army, which I'm going to ask her about too. She was the winner of the 2015 HR Game Changer Award, the HDC's Chief Executive Award in 2015, and named as one of the top 12 HR people in New Zealand in 2016. And she joins me now, having run up a bunch of stairs, having had a fire alarm. Welcome, Meredith.
Kia ora, Colin. Thank you for having me.
There's nothing like preparing for a podcast by all of a sudden your entire morning going out of the window. And of course, fire drills are important, of course they are, for safety reasons. But it's not what you want in your day. And just on safety, while I'm there, and this is something that you'll see over the course of your career so far, is of course we did safety drills, you know, primarily to focus on just to make sure everything's working, particularly in Wellington, we have lots of earthquakes. But it was all about physical safety. And in the last 10 years, you know, maybe not even as long as that, maybe the last 5 years, we've put much more emphasis on emotional safety and psychological safety. Meredith, this has got to be a welcome thing that we're doing now, because for too long it was all about physical safety, right?
Oh, I completely agree. And in fact, I had the same conversation with our elected members this week about, you know, yes, we've got some great focus on the physiological side of safety, but we really need to be embedding the psychosocial hazards and psychological safety into everything that we do. And, you know, I'm aware in Australia and the UK that the psychosocial factors are auditable, you know, legally through the ISO 45003. And I actually welcome that to happen in New Zealand legislation as well. So, you know, good employers are already doing it. They're thinking about it. I would really welcome it going to that next step where we're all required to do it, to be good employers and to take the whole person into account when we look at their well-being in the workplace.
Yeah, there's still a relative, there's still, I would call it an old-fashioned view of psychological safety. It's quite an American concept to some people, like, oh, here we go again, more fluffy stuff. But what we're talking about fundamentally is how human beings feel when they wake up in the morning in relation to the work that they need to do to earn the money to keep themselves safe in their lives. I can't believe it's taken us this long, to be honest, to even think about legislating it in workplaces.
Yeah, I agree. And in fact, you know, it impacts so many parts of our lives, you know, from challenger safety, learning safety, you know, the ability to speak up and feel that your opinion matters. And from a business sense, why would we not be doing that? Because you're going to get so many better outcomes, productivity, you know, wise. And it's not something that I know that a lot of organizations are deliberate about at this point, but, you know, and I saw you talk on a LinkedIn post around how different things are from when we first started in HR a few years ago. And I reflect back often and how wonderful it is to be in 2023 and have these focuses on psychological safety or psychosocial hazards or bringing your whole selves to work.
Yeah, it's great, and long overdue. So, did you study HR, Meredith, at university? I think you went to Massey University, wasn't it? HR the thing that you studied there?
I actually first studied a psychology degree with the full intent that I was going to be a clinical psychologist, and I really realized about in year two that it wasn't for me, and that perhaps I didn't have the patience for it, which is probably a youth thing at the time. But I'd also fallen in love with some elective papers, and they happened to be HR. And so I changed my degree to business psychology. And then I went on to do my master's in management with a HRM endorsement. So it definitely pulled me in. But I do use the organisational psychology aspects of that degree a lot, and it's definitely set me up well.
Yeah, because I think, you know, kind of the early 2000s, there wouldn't have been a strong link in many people's heads between what we then call probably still personnel, and maybe it's just HR then, and organizational psychology. Yeah, I joke all the time about the fact that HR changes its name every 5 years, and don't even get me started on acronyms for projects. But there wasn't that strong link, whereas now there very much is. I was talking to a senior manager at the start of the week about coaching, and you know, I'd made the point that his principal responsibility is to motivate and inspire other people as a senior manager. He was just like, but what about all of the technical stuff? He was like, are you saying that I have to coach people every day? I'm like, yes, exactly what I'm saying. And I think these things are, you know, kind of, again, as we've talked about, they're coming more to the fore. The fact that people have to be more in tune what the human being needs at that one time, which very much speaks to that org psych background that you've got.
Yeah, in fact, I was talking with one of my leaders this morning, and he's been a technical expert in the health and safety space, and he was, you know, reflecting on how important it is to be deliberate about, you know, leadership every single day, and meeting people where they're at, and wanting them to feel great on a Monday about coming to work and not excited on a Friday that, you know, other than the fact they're going to have a couple of days off, but that they're leaving work. Yeah. And we just talked about, you know, that just constant need to be, keep your foot on the pedal, and be deliberate about your leadership constantly. And technical stuff, yeah, we're all good at the technical stuff now, but really it's leaning into that leadership space.
Yeah, leadership means different things to different people. I'm going to go off on a slight tangent. It's one of the questions that I had for you, but while you've mentioned it means different things to different people. You know, for me, it's about making a positive difference to the lives of humans. And not everybody makes the choice to lead, Meredith. We, you know, in the work that we do, we will see that, and it will frustrate us from time to time where people get into senior positions and then don't ever make the choice to take that next step to go, okay, well, I don't need to change who I am. I just need to change how I serve. Is that something you agree with?
Yeah, I see it as a total privilege to be a leader, and you know, from a servanthood perspective, but also the joy that you get when you see people achieve their potential and you achieve outcomes for the organisation or the communities that you serve through your people, and every single day I pinch myself, and because I'm so excited to be in this role and to be able to see all the people in my group or across the council achieve incredible things.
You did a stint, I'm pretty sure I read on LinkedIn you did a stint in the army. Was that during your research? When did all of that happen, and why, and what did you learn, and tell me about it?
just to be clear, I was a civilian in the army. I certainly okay. Didn't
yeah. You weren't in fatigues.
In trenches. I took some time away from the university space because I was actually tutoring and doing some lecturing and research while I was during my master's. And I decided to have some space away from that and try something new. I'd also met a soldier who's now my husband of 18 years. So, and I had no idea what he was talking about most of the time. And you talked about a hate of acronyms. They definitely have a lot of them in the army, and including local government as well. So it was almost, you know, to set myself up with a foundation to understand where he was at and to meet him halfway. And it was just a nice opportunity to see things being done in a different way. So I definitely wasn't in the army, but I did get to go on adventure training, and that was a lot of fun.
I bet it was, yeah. The fact that you weren't in the army actually removes half the jokes I've got about HR and going into battle, and so I won't use any of those, I promise. And so just on the army though, did you get a glimpse, and obviously being married to a soldier, do you get a glimpse of the different culture that they have? You know, one of the things I'm asked all of the time is, do different teams have different cultures? Like, well, yeah, because they have different goals, they require different behaviors. It's like, ultimately what we're trying to do is to create something that's humane and vibrant and celebrates humans, but it's going to be different for the army, I would imagine, because of the way that they're motivated and their drive, right?
Well, it's a matter of necessity. You know, as much as we welcome disruption and asking why in our world, you can't have a soldier ask why when you've been given an order and you're in a battle situation. It has to be that hierarchical, organisational culture that you've been told to do something and you don't question it, because it could mean the difference between life and death. Obviously, when you're in Linton camp, that's not a case on the daily. But they had to manifest that, so that were they to go into battle, which is literally what they are there for, training constantly or for peacekeeping, that they didn't have those issues arise when the time was actually not to question. But I do have to say, I believe they are continuing to have challenges as the new generation comes through, who do think very differently. And there's been a lot of turnover in the forces. And my son actually ended up in the Navy himself for a couple of years. And it was interesting to see how far the NZDF had come, and they've had to, in order to continue to attract people to join, because we don't have compulsory service.
Yeah, I did some work with the Australian Defence Force, with one of the teams there around culture, exactly on that point about evolution and moving away from command and control style, where shouting was the norm. And I think people forget, you know, not every army team is like Full Metal Jacket, where people are in their faces. But I joked at the time that there was a lot of corporate cultures that were like that. It wasn't just the army where people were shouting is the norm. There's still, you know, I'm writing a book on toxic cultures, and some of the stories are just horrendous about people getting in each other's faces. And you're absolutely right. The world has changed, and it's up to cultures. Doesn't matter whether it's the ADF or corporates or sports teams. It's up to us to make sure that we catch up to that, and that we're not trying to drag people back from the world that they want to live in, back to the world. We, you know, I always say that nostalgia is only good if it gives us fuel to learn for the future. It should never be an anchor for the past, right?
Yeah, I agree. And I can say that even back then, when I was with the Army, and, you know, what was still important for them was building that trust, and that that they had each other's backs and they genuinely cared about the well-being of each other, because it's all they had. So there were definitely positive aspects of the culture, and I know that's continued, and particularly around drinking culture was huge back then. And they've moved away from that as well. So it's great to see the evolution in a sector that, you know, has been around for hundreds of years.
Yeah, literally hundreds of years. Yeah, the drinking thing's really interesting. Here I go down another little sidetrack. The drinking thing is interesting because it was almost like a reward for getting to the end of the week. It definitely was during COVID. I'll come back to that one. Yeah. Where we would all go, you know, I remember first Friday drinks being the norm. And I even spoke to somebody recently who's like, why don't kids want to come out on Friday at 5 o'clock? I'm like, well, because they've got more important things that they want to do. They don't want to hang around with their workmates. It's like, that's a relic of the past. And that's just one example. And I imagine in your role at, you know, at City Council, you're seeing a lot of those generational changes, probably, you know, almost on a daily basis, Meredith.
Yeah, and we are. And we're really fortunate to have a large portion of our 2000 workforce who are younger, you know, 29 and under. And it's something I'm really mindful of, because not only do you have to think about what drives them and what, you know, what their desires are, and how we can attract and retain such an incredible, you know, workforce who bring innovation and disruption into the way that we do things. But, you know, you also then have to think about how we all work together and get the best out of all the generations across there. Yeah. I think it's such a beautiful thing, having younger people into the workforce, and they do have very different expectations. And I was listening to a podcast recently, and, you know, where there had been some criticism, I think it was in the UK, around that younger people don't have the same work ethic. And you know, I was, oh, where's this going? And it got to the point, it talked about actually why should the younger workforce have to do plus 40 hours? They're not being paid to do it. Yeah. Have they not got it right? Yeah. You know, and I think about, you know, when you and I kind of came in, and the hours that were expected and what they're expected in, you know, even in Wellington, not so much at Wellington City Council, I think the younger generation are onto something. I'm really open to having my own thinking disrupted constantly. And I'm lucky I've got a lot of younger people in the People and Culture group, and they definitely keep me on my toes.
Yeah, with one organisation, as part of a culture programme, we instituted reverse mentoring for younger members of staff to teach older members of staff how the world works today. That's the way I phrase it. I want it to be an element of fun in involved. But, you know, I talked about quiet quitting recently, and quiet quitting, the media liked, will love all of these stories. Mm. Quiet quitting was a rejection of old fashioned working habits.
Yeah.
You know, this concept of 60 hour weeks, wearing it like a badge of honor. People who love telling you how busy they are, it's like, great, you're rubbish at managing your time. Thanks. Yeah, we get it. You know? And I think, you know, kind of generationally, the way that we look at work is changing, and it's a really, really good thing. It is.
And I'm very, very open to having anything I say or do being questioned. And so that's part of the culture that we've created in my group, and that speak up and actually, have you got alternative ways of doing things? Because we certainly don't have all the answers once you get to leadership.
So tell me a little bit then about your career, Meredith, you know, and how you, you know, kind of have learned about culture, how to do culture well. You know, you talked about the fact that leadership is a privilege, but that's something that we learn along the way, right? So, you know, kind of what was it for you? Did you have mentors along the way? Were there people you looked up to? Was it your own research? How did you really get this ingrained knowledge in culture and how to do things in the right way?
Yeah, look, I've had the privilege of working with some incredible chief executives. And on the flip side, I've also witnessed some train wrecks. Mm. So it's not just a matter of looking at what you should do. It's also a matter of looking at what you shouldn't do. My first chief executive at Horowhenua Council, which is the one in Levin that you were referring to earlier, you know, when he became chief executive, the executive leadership team had been all male, with the exception of me and of a certain age and ethnicity. And he transformed that executive leadership team from, you know, to one where we had dynamic gender balance and ethnic balance, but he really promoted younger women with potential and had full faith that you would just go off and do it, and he was behind you 100%. And it was my first experience of having a male chief executive really being a champion for women in leadership. And then I was lucky to have a great chief executive at UCOL, and that's a polytechnic in the middle of the North Island with a number of campuses. And Lisa Boyce, who is Australian and back at, I think she's at Bond University now, what I learned from her was around that calmness. And I remember being in her office one day, and we were reflecting on the fact we had quite a dramatic executive leadership team. And she said, "Oh, Meredith, I don't do drama." And I giggled at the time. And I said, "It's amazing you've hired so many dramatic people, though." and then, of course, you know, right now I'm under the most incredible chief executive, Barbara Akiro, who has been in local government for 35 years, and she jokes she must have started when she was 5. But that's where I've really learned a lot and continue to learn. I love watching her every day that I get to interact with her. And she's built an ELT or executive leadership team around the first team concept and what that brings, and the accountability across, not just for your own area, and building that trust. And so being part of that journey in the last 4 years since I've been here, we've been able to see a dramatic shift in the culture and the organisation, not just at the executive leadership team level. So I've been really lucky, and I'm really mindful of how lucky I am. So I savour every day, particularly under Barbara's leadership.
Mm. But of course, I know you're too humble to say this, but luck is earned. It's earned through hard work and an element of risk taking, and also I think self-reflection on how we can grow. And I know Wellington City Council has some really strong values, and one of them is we're always improving. How do you apply that to yourself, Meredith? You know, kind of what are you, you know, how do you look to improve the way that you do things?
It's something I'm very deliberate about. And I remember actually hearing an elderly lady who was 103 and it was her birthday party. And she was reflecting back about what's important in life. And she said, it's learning every day, and what a privilege it is to be able to learn and challenge yourself. So, you know, when either things go wrong or you just want a little bit of inspiration, you know, the first thing you need to do is, if they go wrong, is look at yourself as, you know, did I have any part in that? Or, you know, I regularly listen to podcasts. I read a lot of books. My bookshelf looks like the one behind you, actually. A lot of them haven't been read yet because I keep collecting. I'm a very good book collector and keep needing to find the time. But, you know, there's been a couple of books that I've read that I still think about. And they're not specifically HR, but they have been really game changing for me in the last 4 years. And that's Humankind, A Hopeful History by Rutger Bregman. And I often think about that. And the other one is Rebel Ideas by Matthew Syed. And how we can bring disruption into everything we do and that what I do and think about things differently. And, you know, even articles like 21 HR Jobs of the Future, I remember reading that back in 2020. I think it was a Harvard Business Review article, and it made me think about, well, actually, why do people and culture teams have only traditional HR type roles? So, you know, now I have a business improvement manager to look after and support us working on the business of people and culture, because you can be so reactive in the people and culture space, particularly during the COVID period. So it is, you know, applying different disciplines and different thinking into everything that we do. Because one thing with the HR profession is we do at times tend to get ourselves into a hole and think we know it all. But to really deliver great service out into the organization, you need to have that insight into who your people are and what they need and want and don't assume. So I've been really deliberate about bringing and promoting from within the organization into people and culture. So about a third of our group, and there's about 55, 60 of us now, are from other areas in the organization who didn't start off in either health and safety or HR or whatever the, you know, team is that we've got in there. And they bring such a great view. And it really has helped me think differently about how we deliver services, but the wider group as well.
One of the things you just mentioned, COVID, and actually you mentioned Humankind by Rutger Bregman, which is, if you haven't read it, it's a really great book for people listening. One of the things he said in Humankind was, if we believe people can't be trusted, then that's how we'll treat each other, to everybody's detriment. And I think as we move to more hybrid ways of working, which I know Wellington City Council is doing, Meredith, trust is something that we have to build, we have to maintain. Otherwise, it's got this opportunity to eat away at us. You know, people are like, oh, the whole, do we turn cameras on? Do we turn cameras off? I'm like, well, what does it matter? It's still about, you know, trusting people to do a good job, whether you can see their face or not. What challenges have you found with, or what are some positive stories around the move to more hybrid ways of working at City Council?
Yeah, look, we were already dipping our toes in the water before COVID came along. I've had very little sleep, I'm sorry.
It would have been better had we called it TOVID, I think. COVID.
So, you know, and we were looking at flexi options because we have a workforce that doesn't lend itself to, you know, being completely able to work from home. So half of the 2,000 operational, they don't have that available to them. And so we didn't want there to be a have and have not, you know, feeling across the workforce. So we have different flexi options anyway. So flexi hours or flexi role, you know, so job sharing or 9 day fortnights if that's where the team wants to go. But from a working from home perspective, for those that can do it from the council, it has greatly improved the culture in many ways, because that when we were first introducing it, there was a real fear from leaders around how will I know if they're doing, you know, the work. And I was thinking, do you actually sit next to them the whole day and stare at them? That's, you know, right. It's just such a bizarre question. And we are having to think about what that leadership development looks like around how you continue to create collaboration and connectivity in a hybrid setting. We will be focusing mainly as we continue with our hybrid journey around those moments that matter. And so defining those as a team and not a one-size-fits-all for the organization. And activity-based working will be, you know, big for us as well. So it is evolving, and we are taking our leaders on that journey with us. And quite frankly, it's not an option to go back to the way things were, because it's the number one question we get asked at recruitment. You know, what are your flexible working practices? And when you think from an inclusion perspective, it really fully supports, you know, your goals to be an employer that people can be their whole selves, but also acknowledge that they've got different aspects of their life that are even more important than work. And this enables them to have both.
Fabulous, fabulous. I wanted to finish on a really positive note. I know you've got a really busy day, so I got one more question. I noticed that you've been, sorry, I know you've got a really productive day, not busy. Trade my own self there. I noticed on LinkedIn you did a speech at, I think it was the HR game.
Or Disrupt HR, yeah.
Disrupt HR, which we should call out the Disrupt HR team, who do a fabulous job in New Zealand. They're creating a really different dynamic around the way people think about culture. And you talked about kindness. And I think that kindness is one of those behaviors that when you see it consistently in the workplace, it really builds empathy. And empathy is the glue that keeps people together, which gives rise to vibrant culture. I know you'll agree with that. Give us a sense of what kindness means to you and what you'd like to see in the workplace.
Sure. And, you know, and to do that, that talk at Disrupt HR, I actually did quite a bit of research, because it's something that comes natural to me anyway, and I'm really grateful research backs me up.
But, you know, goodness for that.
It's probably why I do all my reading, just to make sure I'm doing the right stuff and validating myself and my leadership. But there are actually tangible benefits and outcomes, productivity as well, and culture-wise and engagement, by practicing kindness as a leader. And so, and in it, you know, I did talk about the fact kindness isn't being about being weak, or it's not just about being nice or being liked. It is genuinely leaning in to understand the individual and them, you know, and their needs, and knowing them and being authentic. And, you know, always questioning your assumptions when you're in a conversation, where you kind of think, oh, they might be going down the wrong path here, but then just continuing to ask questions. And that's the kind and right thing to do, by always taking people at face value. And when you have had those assumptions come up, you do question them.
Fantastic. What a great way to end the show. Meredith, thank you so much for giving up your time today. And thanks so much for being a guest on the Culture Makers podcast.
Thank you so much, Colin.
Thanks so much for listening to the podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the link with your colleagues and friends, or with your connections on social media. If you'd like to find out more about the work that I do, head to www.colindellis.com or find me on LinkedIn.